following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Without freedom of the press, no democratic form of government could exist.
We switch you now to London.
I'm standing on a rooftop, looking out over London.
Good night, and good luck.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York.
NBC presents Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight. With Peter Jennings in London, Max Robinson in Chicago, and from our desk in Washington, Frank Reynolds.
Good evening.
This historic legislation, the telecommunications law, will create many, many high wage jobs, will create opportunity and better lives for all Americans.
When the press is free, the people of a country are free. When the press is not free, the people of a country are in danger of slavery.
Keeping you informed with information, news, and the views of people making the news. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
All right. Well, welcome to a Thursday. What happened there? Oh, there we go. Welcome to a Thursday, a glitch-filled Thursday. I am Nicole Sandler here at NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network. I was going to start today launching right into healthcare because this is still tomorrow is the day. Mitch McConnell, or maybe Saturday, Mitch McConnell says he's going to get his revised TrumpCare 2.0 over to the Congressional Budget Office to have them score it so that when Congress returns from their July 4th recess, they'll have a new score, and then he'll have 3 weeks to take a vote and get it passed. We'll get to that. In fact, Jackie Schechner will be joining us today to talk about what's in the bill and why it is so imperative that we stay on it because, well, as you heard Lenny Kravitz sing, it ain't over till it's over. I hear everybody, you know, from John McCain on down saying, you know, if pigs fly, this thing will be ready tomorrow or it'll pass or whatever. I don't trust it. I don't trust them. We'll get a little further into that, but I've got to start with the press again. I really do. Yesterday, I made a stupid mistake. I said this clip from JFK was from December of 63. Well, that would have been impossible. But sometime in 1963, JFK, about the media, said,
"He's as far as being able to move in secret and all the rest. There's a terrific disadvantage not having the abrasive quality of the press applied to you daily to an administration. When you have, even though we never like it, and even though we don't have, even though we wish they didn't write it, and even though we disapprove, there isn't any doubt that we couldn't do the job at all in a free society without a very, very active press."
There has always been an adversarial relationship between the press and the White House. There's a reason for the Fourth Estate. There's a reason that a free press is enshrined in the First Amendment of the Constitution. It's imperative in a free society. But this administration and this president doesn't seem to believe in that. We have a president with not only orange skin, but a really, really thin skin. So I was watching Morning Joe this morning. I know I've had a mostly hate-filled relationship with that show over the years, and I flip back and forth between that and CNN's New Day. Sorry, I can't do fucks and friends. I can't do it. And that doesn't mean that I think that what MSNBC does in the morning or for what CNN does in the morning is great television. But I do wake up really early and I need to get my news fix. Frankly, if I didn't do this for a living, if I didn't talk to you every day about what's going on in the world, I wouldn't feel so compelled to watch these shows and to read as much as I read each day. But I have to. It's my job. And I got to tell you, although I know I take some criticism, I've been watching Morning Joe more and more in recent days, probably because Joe Scarborough, as much as I really dislike everything he stands for, has really been openly critical of what's wrong with Donald Trump's presidency. And that's got to be hard for him. First of all, I know they at least used to be friends. Second of all, Joe Scarborough is a Republican, a conservative Republican, and he likes nothing more than to be a cheerleader for the right. So it's got to irk him every day he's got to criticize this president, and he does it. Now, Meekah, how I used to refer to her, she's been really outspoken, and I'm glad for it. We need people who are going to criticize, and granted, there are a number of people on cable news who are criticizing this administration. Cable news is far from a perfect venue, as Cliff Schechter and I were discussing yesterday. In many ways, they are so complicit. They are one of the main reasons that I believe Trump is in the White House. But I think that's more a function of the management of say CNN, who made the decision to run those rallies ad nauseum during the campaign. To give him as much airtime as they could because he was good for ratings, because he was like the train wreck that people couldn't turn away from. But now we're stuck with him. And now that we have him, it's good that they're speaking out against him. So, again, Chuck Todd, I'm not the biggest Chuck Todd fan. I think he tries sometimes to be fair. Although every now and then he comes out with a doozy. But the other night on his MTP Daily, he said this.
I'm obsessed with the White House's war on the press and on media. And let's be clear about this. That war is nothing less than a war on the truth. Do we get it right all the time? Nope, we don't. And when we don't, we run a correction. And in some cases, people lose their jobs. That's what just happened at CNN. CNN took responsibility for its mistakes. You know, at this network, we've done it quite a few times publicly as well. But because we try to get it right. We take what we do seriously because trust, viewers and readers' trust is all we have, and without that, we're nothing. And guess what? We all know we get fired for not telling the truth.
Yep.
And of course, that's the point, isn't it? Of course, the White House attacks delegitimize the media to create running room for its version of events. It's as old as the media itself. White House is not above using anonymous sources to criticize the use of anonymous sources, nor to promote what even it admits could be a lie to call others liars. Here's White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders attacking CNN in an unbelievable way. Take a listen.
There's a video circulating now, whether it's accurate or not. I don't know, but I would encourage everybody in this room and frankly, everybody across the country to take a look at it. I think if it is accurate, I think it's a disgrace to all of media, to all of journalism.
Excuse me? You got that? I don't know whether it's accurate or not,
yep.
But go take a look at it because it disgraces you? Seriously?
Seriously.
And that's been this White House's MO, peddle a false story to claim the media is telling false stories? Sarah Huckabee Sanders was just a bit more honest, apparently, about that White House dishonesty. So no, Mr. President, no White House press shop. The media is not the enemy of the people. We're just here to find, as Carl Bernstein put it so well, the best obtainable version of the truth. And sometimes the truth hurts, can hurt us, and yes, even you, Mr. President.
You know, so he makes a reference to Carl Bernstein there. Last night, David and I watched a program we had recorded on the DVR. It was Watergate or All the President's Men Revisited. It was a special that MSNBC put together. Unfortunately, our DVR only recorded the first hour. But it made me long for the days when there was that respected adversarial relationship between the media and the White House. Now, again, Nixon hated the media, and Donald Trump is taking a page from Nixon's playbook. But the White House would never think to shut down the White House press briefing or say, you can't have the cameras on, or you can't run any audio, or you can't even take a picture of it. It's like, don't even look at it. Sorry, bad reference there. But, I'm longing for the good old days when, the Washington Post could do their job. And although the White House tried to discredit them, they soldiered on. Chris Hayes the other night, and Chris Hayes I'm a lot more a fan of than I am of Chuck Todd, he talked about the chilling attacks on the media.
The president is very explicitly linking a complaint about a media entity to a threat, or at least implied threat, against the corporation associated with it. He did this as a candidate, too. During an October speech, he followed up a string of complaints about the media with this.
Amazon, which through its ownership controls the Washington Post, should be paying massive taxes, but it's not paying.
Yeah, they are.
And it's a very unfair playing field. And you see what that's happening and what that's doing to department stores all over the country.
But now he's the president, and his attacks come with the potential force of the state. It's reminiscent of how things worked in Mubarak's Egypt, in Putin's Russia, and Erdogan's Turkey. The president has not actually taken action against Amazon, but the language is chilling.
Chilling. Chilling. But it gets worse, because today we saw the president, for the 10-year-old that he is, for the skin, thin-skinned, orange-skinned thing that he is. My God, you're the president of the United States. Grow a spine. All right. So, or grow some thicker skin, because you're going to get criticism. This is, it comes, goes with the territory. So I'm watching Morning Joe this morning, and they're talking about, I guess, an incident that Politico reported on where Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, had a bit of a temper tantrum. Here from Raw Story, MSNBC's Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski hammered President Donald Trump over reports that his Secretary of State feels sidelined by White House political operatives. Tillerson reportedly unloaded on Johnny DeStefano, the head of the presidential personnel office, last week in front of other staffers during a heated meeting in the White House chief of staff's office. And Mika Brzezinski and Joe Scarborough blasted the president and his dysfunctional administration. Brzezinski said, quote, "Everybody in Washington in the administration needs to look at this from, I think, a point of view where they're not lobotomized because you're sitting in there and you're so scared of him and you think you need to suck up to the president. You need to look at this like any company." She continued, "Let's say someone came into NBC and took over NBC and started tweeting wildly about people's appearances, bullying people, talking about people in the competition, lying every day, undermining his managers, throwing them under the bus. That person would be thrown out. It's just not normal behavior. In fact, there would be concerns that the person who runs the company is out of his mind." And then Raw Story continues, says Brzezinski continued to sound the alarm that Trump's behavior had no historical parallel in the U.S., but more closely resembled actions by authoritarian foreign leaders. Quote, There are these legitimate concerns at this point. We have never seen anything like this before. Is there any precedent in history in the United States of America? Yes, there may be precedent in other countries. That's not a good sign. So that was the discussion that was being had on Morning Joe this morning. And it's a discussion that's been had a lot. Frankly, Donald Trump is insane. The man, and you know, if not insane, then certainly he's got mental issues. He's a narcissist. As we discussed yesterday, he's a megalomaniac. He's obsessed with his own power. He's obsessed with what people think of him. And he uses Twitter to lash out. Now, there have been discussions that they would take the Twitter away from him or that his tweets would be vetted, but they didn't. Obviously, that never materialized, and he's still tweeting. So what happened is, this morning, Trump tweeted right at the end of the show, and by this time I was already in here and working on What's News, so I didn't hear the very end of the show, but they repeat. Their 8 o'clock hour is a repeat of their 6 o'clock hour for the most part. I know they sometimes edit new stuff in there, but I think it was probably the same discussion that they had. Well, Trump gets on the Twitter, and he tweets, I heard poorly rated Morning Joe speaks badly of me. Don't watch anymore. Then, how come low IQ crazy Mika, along with psycho Joe, came to Mar-a-Lago 3 nights in a row around New Year's Eve and insisted on joining me? She was bleeding badly from a facelift. I said no. First of all, you lying piece of shit, and I can't believe I'm defending Mika Brzezinski, but I know enough about, just from watching her, to know that if she had a facelift and was bleeding badly or not, she wouldn't be going out to a New Year's Eve party at Mar-a-Lago. Now, it's amazing that I even have to spend time talking about this, that the President of the United States of America actually took time out of his day at 9 o'clock in the morning. That's about what time it happened, a little before 9 a.m., to tweet that out. But then Sarah Huckabee Sanders goes on Fox Television. I don't know the name of the person she was talking to, but he brings this up and was actually he actually seemed a bit incredulous at the same thing that I'm incredulous about.
There were a few tweets that went out earlier today, and I want you to get a react to this, okay? This was a suggestion about some folks at MSNBC on a morning program there. Here's what he said. I heard poorly rated Morning Joe, referring to Joe Scarborough, speaks badly of me, don't watch anymore. Then how come low IQ crazy Mika, meaning Mika Brzezinski, the co-host, along with Psycho Joe, came to Mar-a-Lago three nights in a row during New Year's Eve, around New Year's Eve, and insisted on joining me? She was bleeding badly from a facelift. I said no. What is the White House saying about why that went out today?
Look, I don't think that the president's ever been someone who gets attacked and doesn't push back.
It'll come back in a second, I hope.
Attacks, not just to him, but to, frankly, everyone around him. People on that show have personally attacked me many times. This is a president who fights fire with
you?
Fire and certainly will not be allowed to be bullied by liberal media and the liberal elites within the media or Hollywood or anywhere else.
I get it, but is that necessary?
Look, I think what's necessary is to push back against unnecessary attacks on the president, both personally. I've seen far worse things come out of that show. Again, directed not just at the president, but everyone around him. Personal
really?
Attacks, mean,
really?
Hateful attacks. And again, this president isn't going to sit back and not push back. And he's
going to
fight fire with fire. And I think that's exactly what he did.
I've heard
today.
That from you and I've heard that from him. But it just seems like it is entirely more personal than it needs to be. And I'm wondering if you want to address that.
I think I have addressed that as much as I can in terms of the president, again, isn't going to be somebody who's bullied and allows people
bullied?
Himself and those around him to be personally attacked.
He would argue that he's always going to punch back and he's not going to fire the first shot. And perhaps he feels the criticism toward him is unwarranted.
I mean, the outrageous attacks that take place on that show day in, day out, not just at the president and not against his policies, not against things that he's pushing, but they're personal and they're not just directed at him, but again, everyone around him. I've been called a lot of names on that show that don't have
really?
Anything to do with.
Because I watched the show. I haven't heard ever
or
been called a name.
Or policy,
ever.
But they're personal attacks.
Is there something we need to know more about this relationship?
Not that I'm aware of. I couldn't speak to anything.
There is no backstory that has not become public that would lead him to choose this wording?
I honestly wouldn't. I'm not aware of any extra backstory on that.
And I don't know if there's any backstory either, except that they used to be friends, right? But once they got critical of him, then it's fake news, then it's attacks, then it's... Now look, again, it rankles every nerve in my body to have to defend Mika Brzezinski and Joe Scarborough. But again, I've been watching this show more often than not over the last couple of months. And I've never heard them attack Sarah Huckabee Sanders. I've heard them attack Trump, but it's always warranted. I mean, he's the president of the United States. It comes with the territory and he can't handle it. It is just mind-boggling. So this afternoon, there was another White House press briefing. Sarah Huckabee Sanders was at the podium. It was right before I came on the air, so I wasn't able to record it, but I was following along on Twitter. And a lot of the questions were about this. Now, Sanders said, and it's not a direct quote because I don't have it right in front of me, but said that Trump has never, ever advocated violence.
Oh! Chill, 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 chill. You ain't got to grab him like that. You ain't got to grab him like that. You ain't
anyone else like that. Recognize this lady close?
Do you believe that you've done anything to create a tone where this kind of violence would be encouraged?
I hope not. I truly hope not.
Well, I certainly don't incite violence. I don't condone violence. And I don't talk about violence.
But he has a history of encouraging violence. This was a video. I thought I had audio of the attack montage. He has a history of inciting violence at his rallies, of saying he'll pay for the legal fees for somebody who would punch out a protester. I did have a montage of it somewhere. Can't find it at the moment. But you know that. I don't have to play it for you. You've heard them over and over and over again. Here's one of them, I think. Maybe not.
This is the day we take our country back. Remember that. This is the day we take our country back. So I got a little notice, in case you see, the security guys. We have wonderful security guys. They said, Mr. Trump, there may be somebody with tomatoes in the audience. So if you see somebody getting ready to throw a tomato, knock the crap out of them, would you? Seriously.
You know, stuff like that. He did it all the time. He said he'd pay the legal fees. Regardless, this is beneath the dignity of the office. Not that that office has dignity anymore. It really doesn't. You know, there's a Pew Global Attitudes poll out, and it shows the standing of the United States of America has fallen to levels. I think when Barack Obama left office, he left with a rating of about 64 on the international scale. It is now in the 20s. You know, and Donald Trump had the nerve to talk about other countries laughing at us. Believe me, Mr. President, they're laughing at you now. Stop it. I kept saying, I hope he keeps tweeting because it gives us a vision into what he's really thinking. This kind of shit's got to stop. It's bad enough he's taking down the whole country when it comes to healthcare, when it comes to so many other things. This stuff is beyond what's normal. It's just not normal. Also, what's not normal is this push to kick 22, 23 million people off of healthcare. We'll take a break. We'll check in with what's news and come back on the other side with Jackie Schechner to get the latest on the Republicans' attempt to do just that. We'll be right back.
I read the news today, oh boy.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
The first poll numbers on the Senate's Trump Care 2.0 bill are out, and they're ugly, ranging from 12 to 17% in support of the plan from Suffolk University, USA Today, NPR Marist, and Quinnipiac polls. The Quinnipiac poll shows nearly half of Americans strongly disapprove of the bill versus just 6% who would strongly approve of it. Only 18% of Republicans support the bill and say they feel strongly about its passage.
Last week, Mitch McConnell and his gang of 12 finally unveiled their super secret Obamacare repeal bill. Guess what the big secret was?
The Senate bill sucks.
Tremendously unpopular.
A massive tax cut to the wealthiest households paid for by cutting health care coverage for poor, working, and sick Americans.
It's called trickle down. Poor people will still get access to the antibiotics that rich people shed in their urine.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is still planning to send a revised version of the bill to the Congressional Budget Office for scoring by Friday as Congress heads home for the 4th of July recess. His goal is to bring the new bill to a vote during the 3 weeks they'll be back in D.C. before taking off for the month of August. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, in response to the president's meeting with just the Republican caucus, suggested a fresh start.
So I'd make my friends on the Republican side and President Trump an offer. Let's turn over a new leaf. Let's start over. Let's abandon more tax breaks for the rich. Let's abandon cuts to Medicaid and discuss what the American people are really concerned about. Premiums, deductibles, the cost and quality of health care. President Obama invited both parties, Democrats and Republicans, to Blair House to discuss health care reform in front of the American people early in his first term as president. President Trump, I challenge you to invite us, all 100 of us, Republican and Democrat, to Blair House to discuss a new bipartisan way forward on health care in front of all the American people.
President's response?
Mr. President, Senator Schumer says he'd like to come down and have all 100 senators come here to talk health care. Would you be willing to negotiate with all of them?
I've got to find out if he's serious. He hasn't been serious. Obamacare is such a disaster, such a wreck, and he wants to try and save something that's really hurting a lot of people. He'd have to be very, very serious. You know, he's done a lot of talking, bad talking, and He just doesn't seem like a serious person.
Who's not serious? Meanwhile, protests against the Senate GOP health bill took place throughout the Capitol on Wednesday. On the Capitol lawn, dozens of activists and Democratic lawmakers continued what they're calling the people's filibuster. Inside the Russell Senate office building, activists stormed the offices of at least six senators, culminating in 40 arrests. A list of the senators most likely to vote against the legislation and their contact information is available at TrumpCareToolkit.org. A limited version of Trump's travel ban goes into effect Thursday night, with new criteria for visa applicants from six predominantly Muslim countries and all refugees that require a close family or business tie to the U.S. Journalists, students, workers, or lecturers who have valid invitations or employment contracts in the U.S. would be exempt from the ban. The Supreme Court will hear the case in the fall. Donald Trump held his first fundraiser of the 2020 presidential election Wednesday night at the Trump International Hotel in Washington, D.C., raising an estimated $10 million at the $35,000 a plate dinner. Press was not allowed inside the event to hear the president's remarks. Protesters were outside with signs, and chants of shame, shame could reportedly be heard inside. Tension between the White House and the media continues to grow. On CNN, one of the loudest critics of the recent policy of no cameras rolling in the White House briefing room, Jim Acosta, complained on Wednesday.
What we're witnessing right now is just this erosion of our freedoms in terms of covering the President of the United States.
Acosta went further in calling the president himself a purveyor of fake news.
The President of the United States is himself a purveyor of fake news. He is the founding father of birtherism, the false claim that President Obama was born in another country. President Obama was born in Hawaii. He came out right after his inauguration and said his inauguration crowds were bigger than President Obama's when they weren't, and that we had photographic evidence from the National Park Service to prove that point. He alleged that millions of undocumented people voted against him and gave Hillary Clinton the popular vote in the 2016 election. The White House is just finally cobbling together a voter fraud commission that is going to investigate this. At the end of the day, they're going to find out there was not millions of people voting fraudulently in this country, as we all know. He accused President Obama of wiretapping him at Trump Tower. As we followed that saga for several weeks, it started off as a claim of wiretapping, then it became overall surveillance, and then they were hitting Susan Rice for unmasking people improperly, and then never produced any kind of evidence of wiretapping at Trump Tower. And then he hinted at those James Comey tapes that never existed. And I think, Don, this is the reason why the president has only held one news conference, one full news conference since coming into office, that one in February. It's because if he holds a news conference, we're going to ask all of these questions. What about the wiretapping at Trump Tower? What about the Jim Comey tapes? He just is not going to have answers for any of that, and that is why he's been avoiding these kinds of questions. I got good
news. And that's a bit of what's news right now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports, I hope you'll consider a contribution. What's News and the Nicole Sandler Show are 100% listener supported, and we can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com/donate.
This is a huge, huge issue.
And we're talking about it. The Nicole Sandler Show on Progressive Voices and NicoleSandler.com.
All right, we are back, and I'm really excited for our next guest. It's been a while since we've spoken, but you know Jackie Schechner from the Stephanie Miller Show and from Ask Me Anything with John Fugelsang. Tell me anything, or tell me everything, right? I'm mixing
tell
up.
Tell me everything.
Tell me everything. Anything and everything on SiriusXM's Insight. Jackie Schechner, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's absolutely my pleasure.
So I know, look, going back, it seems like forever ago, but it hasn't been that long. You were the go-to person to talk about everything happening with the Affordable Care Act. Throughout the whole negotiations, you were reporting on it, and you were the most up-to-date person that I knew on top of everything. And I've no doubt you're following this debacle just as closely, although not as happily, probably.
Yeah, no, I mean, for people who don't know, I was the National Communications Director for Healthcare for America Now. So I worked as an advocate in D.C. to push to get comprehensive national healthcare reform. And then I moved back into journalism and was current TV, where I joined up with Stephanie and Stephanie Miller Show and Bill Press Show, while I was doing political news, I was also kind of the network's healthcare expert, because at that point I had all of this information about healthcare and healthcare policy. I knew that we would revisit this issue, obviously, when we have a Republican-controlled House and Senate, and unfortunately a Republican-controlled White House as well. But I never thought in a million years that what would be proposed would be just so inherently cruel.
Cruel is the word. I mean, Donald Trump himself called it mean, but cruel is more like it. This will it will hurt the people who are in the worst position, the neediest among us. It will take health care from them, and the money, the savings gleaned from that, would go to give the wealthiest among us a massive tax break.
Yeah, I think we need to be careful too, because, you know, I was talking to Fugel saying earlier in the week about this, and, you know, he doesn't think that this Senate bill will see the light of day. I disagree. I worry about it, because we didn't think that the House bill, as atrocious mm-hmm. as it was going to get through, and they tinkered around the edges and they managed to eke out the votes. So I worry about the same thing happening in the Senate, and we're already seeing a little bit of that emerge. There was some news last night that came out that there was some money added in for combating opioid addiction, and then also there was a provision that was added in that would allow people, and I find this comical, to use money in their health savings accounts to pay for premiums.
Oh, my God.
And the reason why that's so funny is that nobody has money set aside in a health savings account. It's a tax shelter for the rich.
That's
and
right.
If they do, then they could afford their premiums. Like, it's
right.
it's a bizarre thing to say, you know, you can use the money that you've set aside tax-free, this extra money that you have lying around, to pay for your health insurance premiums. It just doesn't make any sense. And if anybody, you know, it's healthcare policy 101, also adding that the health savings accounts are tied to high deductible plans. So, you know, none of it is realistic in the healthcare policy world, but they are these little add-ons that are being used to try to curate a certain number of votes for this terrible bill, and I worry about that.
Right. Well, you know, when the idea of an additional $45 billion to combat the opioid crisis is there to appease Rob Portman and Senator Capito of West Virginia. Obviously, those are problems in those states, in most states these days as well. But that's because the savings from the taxes that were put in place to pay for the Affordable Care Act, this is the money they're talking about would be used for deficit reduction, right? And that's why they could get this done under reconciliation, because they'd save somewhere in the neighborhood of $300 billion. Well, now they're saying they're basically going to use that money to try to bribe these moderates with money to pay for their concerns.
Right. I mean, that's what they're doing, is they're taking the extra money and trying to buy off the votes. And, you know, I think that we need to take a step back, too, is that we know that Trump doesn't know anything about healthcare policy. And we know that Ryan doesn't care. We know McConnell doesn't care. Right. For them, this is a political, they're trying to get a political win. They want to put a check mark on the book to say that they repealed and replaced Obamacare and move on to other things. So they're not putting any kind of concern or any sort of real healthcare policy know-how into this. This is just trying to eke out the political win. And that's what's so devastating about it, is because if we really took a long, hard look at the Affordable Care Act, we could really improve upon it, and we could make it a healthcare system that works for most Americans. You're not going to get a policy, I think, that works for everybody always, because we're an incredibly large society with lots of different people, and you're going to have to work towards a complete solution like that. But as we modify our healthcare system in a way that works for more people, you have to build upon the foundation that you've created. This doesn't do that in any way, shape, or form. And when you put 13 white men in a room, rich white men for that matter, and they start to write policy that works for them politically, you're not taking into account all of the different components of healthcare in this country that actually matter and make a difference in people's lives.
Right. So you know, the one thing the Democrats have said all along is the Affordable Care Act is a starting point, and then we need to improve on it. And we know that. I mean, look, before it even passed, we talked about it. It was far from perfect, and there was the old "Don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good." The fact is, we got, you know, no longer could an insurance company cancel you or refuse to sell you a policy because of a pre-existing condition. Any middle-aged person in this country has some sort of pre-existing condition. And we heard the horror stories of, you know, someone who got sick and then the insurance company canceled them because they said, you didn't tell us that you had acne when you were 14, and that's a pre-existing condition, and so your policy is now effectively over. They wanted, this would return us to that, although they're saying that the Senate bill has protections for pre-existing conditions. What they don't tell you is that it gives the states the right to get a waiver.
Yeah, to opt out of it, and also that, you know, just because you say somebody is covered for pre-existing conditions doesn't guarantee that they're covered at the same rate as everybody else.
Right.
So you can guarantee coverage for pre-existing conditions, but if somebody's priced out of it, then that does them no good. And so it can come down to the point where insurance companies say, look, I'll sell you a policy, but I'm not going to cover anything having to do with cancer because you've got a pre-existing condition in cancer. So I'll cover everything else. But God forbid you get cancer or you have a reoccurrence of cancer, that's not covered. And all that has to come out on your own. Or, you know, we'll charge you an exorbitant amount of money to make sure that that's included, and now you're priced out of the market completely. So these are the details that matter. These are the things, like, you can speak in generalities, but these are the specifics that matter. And I like to say everybody loves their health insurance until they need to use it. Because everybody thinks they have a great plan, and then when push comes to shove and you're in an emergency situation, you find out in really the most opportune moments what your health insurance does and doesn't cover.
But, and that's how it used to be, because they could sell an insurance policy, like you said, that didn't cover cancer or that had all these exclusions. People would say, but I used to pay $50 a month and had insurance. What they didn't know is that insurance was useless. It didn't cover an emergency room. It didn't cover prescription drugs. It didn't, you know, it didn't cover a myriad of things. And when you needed it, that's when you found out that it was no good. So people who bitched and moaned that their premiums went up. Now, in some cases, they went up exorbitantly. And that was one of the big problems of the Affordable Care Act, that there were no real protections on costs. That's one of the things that could be fixed.
Yeah. I mean, we didn't get what we wanted in terms of cost control, but that's where the public option would have been great. Mm-hmm. Because people didn't understand this, is that if you create a public option, and we use the word option, right, because you have the opportunity to choose whether or not you want to use a public plan. That was the whole point of an option. If you put a public option in the mix, that public option says, look, this is what things cost. This is the baseline. And the insurance companies have to make a decision. They can either continue to jack up prices, or they can compare themselves to the public option and have to show, you know, why it is that they're more expensive than the public option. And that would really be a moment of truth for these insurance companies when they price things. The way it works now is they have monopolies in states. They compete against each other to see how much the market will bear. They're not interested in garnering the business of the people who need their product the most. And their only financial obligation, their only real obligation, frankly, legally, is to make as much money for their shareholders as humanly possible. They're not interested in covering the people who need their product. So when you put a public option in the mix, you have a baseline by which to judge all other health insurance plans. When that got scrapped, and that got scrapped, you know, by the Republicans, and then some Democrats got in there and really did a number on it, but when we got rid of the public option, we got rid of the benchmark by which to judge health insurance companies and health insurance prices. So yes, the premiums keep going up, but if you're really all that interested in cost control, you would be in favor of a public option in the mix.
Of course. Of course. In fact, the funny thing is, I don't know if you heard this, Rand Paul was on CNN the other night with Aaron Burnett, and he made sort of an inadvertent case for a public option for single payer. In fact, I've got just happened to have the audio right here, so let me share this with you.
What we should do is, rather than dictate to people what kind of insurance they can get, we should try to give them options. So, for example, the individual market, if you're a plumber and it's you and your wife and you're the two of you and you're the insurance pool, it's a terrible place to be. but it's not part of the free market. It's an artifact of tax policy dating back to World War II that said insurance is going to be tied to employment. If we weren't doing that, and if we said to the people in the individual market, to the plumber, you can join the Chamber of Commerce, you can join the Plumbers Association, you can join the Individuals That Want a Group Together Association and buy your insurance as a group, you could get a way out of that individual conundrum. You could get group policies, and most of the group policies actually have things like pregnancy. If you work for General Motors, my guess is pregnancy is automatically in your insurance because you're a big group and you have the leverage to demand it from your insurance company.
So why not go for the biggest company group of all and just have insurance for everybody?
Well, socialism's not a good idea, and I know you can ask my friend Senator Sanders, but socialism's an utter failure. It leads to poverty,
starvation. But you did just make a great argument for nationalized health care. You said the bigger the group, the lower the cost, so all I'm taking is your argument to its logical conclusion, Senator.
I was talking about voluntary groups, not the gulag. But I'm talking about when people go... join together. Large associations are a good idea. Collective bargaining is not a bad idea. Labor getting together, but that's not the government doing it. That's just people getting together to have more leverage in the marketplace. So I'm all for trying to balance the equation with insurance companies. I think they have too much power, but I'm not willing to have the government break them up.
But what he doesn't address is the government is the people. Right? The Republicans always like to, you know, talk about the government as the big bad boogeyman, but the government is the people.
Yeah, I mean, people need to understand single payer doesn't mean single distributor of health care.
Right.
Right? You're not talking about government doctors. What you're talking about is a single payer. It's a single entity that pays the bill. It streamlines the financial process. But it's not, or the billing process, but it's not you have the same doctors, the same hospitals. Yeah, it's one of the things I learned when I was over in Spain, right? It's the same system, right? Everybody uses the same system of doctors and hospitals. Now, there is a private insurance option that people who have more money can buy into, and they can get access to doctors on off hours and that sort of thing. But it's the same people. You're not talking about government doctors or government administered health care. You're just talking about government.
Who pays the bill?
The bill payer.
Right. It's either, the government pays the bill at a 2% overhead, 2-3% overhead, or the insurance company does it at a 20% overhead. And it's only 20% because that was mandated by the Affordable Care Act. It used to be higher.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the advertising and the salaries and the overhead, and it's just, I mean, that marketing, I mean, the money is wasted on so many other things.
Yep.
You know, it's sad. And really, I mean, what the funny thing is about the clip that you just played is that that's the whole foundation of insurance, is spreading the risk. And if you take away the individual mandate that says that people have to buy insurance, and you take away the group, the employer mandate that says employers have to provide insurance, and people just go about buying what they want to buy when they want to buy, the whole foundation of insurance falls apart. So inadvertently, he's advocating for things like mandates and requirements, because you got to get everybody in the pool in order for the insurance system to work.
But then he's fighting against it as well, because I don't know if you saw, he put out a list of demands in order to get his vote. I think Rand Paul, no matter what happens, is a no vote, but for the wrong reasons. One thing he said was that he would like to see, they put in the Senate bill a provision that if you go without insurance, if you let your insurance lapse for more than 63 days, then there is a mandated 6-month waiting period. So say something happens and you lose your job and you don't have the money, you can't afford it, and you have a lapse in insurance coverage and you get sick. You can't buy it for 6 months. Well, that's enough time to kill somebody, first of all. But he was saying he doesn't want to see that, because that's just as bad as the individual mandate. Well, it seems like he wants it both ways.
Yeah, well, the other reason why that's dangerous is that the insurance companies are notorious for making billing mistakes. And so often I've had this where I've signed up for like an auto pay and then it doesn't work, and I get a notice saying I'm behind because it didn't automatically take the money, and then there's a cancellation. And if you've ever tried to backtrack an action like that, it's incredibly tedious. I've had things go to collections that never actually came to me first, through the insurance industry. So people end up getting, and I'm really fastidious about my financial situation and making sure that I pay things on time. So if I'm having difficulty with these sorts of things, imagine how often this is happening to people who aren't as paying as close attention or have other obligations, and this is not at the top of their list. They're trying to feed their families. They're trying to just get the kids out the door every day. They're trying to just go about their lives. They don't have the inclination to fight an insurance company to get their policy reinstated because somebody along the way made a billing error.
Right. No, I hear exactly what you're saying. I've had the same thing happen. I still get collection notices from things from years ago that I know was paid through insurance. So that's true. And so that the 6 month waiting period, that's just cruel, to go back to your original word. Jackie Schechner is with us. Obviously, we're talking about this Republican plan. Now, the deal is, obviously, the CBO score came out for the Senate plan. It freaked everyone out. Lots of the Republicans who were on the fence. Susan Collins came out, and I'm not usually a big Susan Collins fan, but she was very articulate on what her fundamental issues with the bill are.
I will say that I have so many fundamental problems with the bill that have been confirmed by the CBO report that it's difficult for me to see how any tinkering is going to satisfy my fundamental and deep concerns about the impact of the bill.
That wasn't the clip I thought it was, but she's laid them out. And I mean, her problem are the cuts to Medicaid. Again, you've got the people who can least afford to lose the coverage, the neediest among us who are going to be hit the hardest. That seems to be the sticking point with a lot of these senators. And I don't see them coming around. However, I worry when you say that John Fugelsang doesn't think it'll see the light of day. I worry that Mitch McConnell is going to take that extra $200 billion and try to buy them off. And that's why I'm so...
I think so, too.
We've talked about this nonstop now for almost 2 weeks because I think it's that important. Jackie, what do you see in this bill that people may not know about that they should worry about?
Well, it's just besides the fact that it's just so inherently evil. I think people need to worry about rolling back the consumer protections of the Affordable Care Act. I think people need to worry about what is and isn't covered. I think people need to worry about, the Medicaid expansion. So people understand, right? The idea is to allow people access to medical services if they don't make enough money to purchase a private health insurance plan on the exchange,
right,
and then get subsidized for that coverage. So you're talking about people who now can go to community clinics, who now can go see a doctor.
Can go to Planned Parenthood.
Right, and you're not seeing, well, that's a big part of this, too. Mm-hmm. You're not seeing people go to the emergency room with conditions that are worse than they needed to be because they couldn't afford to go see a doctor early on. Planned Parenthood's another one, right? Planned Parenthood takes care of women all across this country. I know that there's concern over their abortion services. That is such a small portion of what they do. They do cancer screenings. They do wellness visits. They take care of women's health up and down the board. And I think that pulling that away is really just incredibly cruel to us as a society and who we are and taking care of each other. There's a lot in here. It's sort of hard to pick a favorite provision.
No, it's right.
I think the idea that you can charge somebody older five times as much as somebody younger for their health insurance, the fact that these tax credits that are being offered are pegged to age and not to,
yep,
to salary or to income. It's one thing after another, and I think, not wanting to get too deep into the weeds, because I feel like that's where we lose people, the importance here is that this is not a health care bill that is designed to improve your health care. This is a tax cut designed to be masked as a repeal and replace bill, and it's not going to improve upon the health care system. And all of the people who are complaining that they hate Obamacare, need to educate themselves about what the Affordable Care Act is and does, and all of the things that are going to be rolled back if this bill becomes law.
Well, that's
the part that's that's most important.
That's exactly it. And think back to before the Affordable Care Act was enacted. I mean, and again, I use myself as an example. First of all, I'm a 57-year-old woman, so I'm right in the middle. I'm in the most vulnerable age group, because if they want to charge me, I think the Affordable Care Act limits it to, it's either two times or three times what they can charge younger people. This would make it five times. If my insurance premium, and right now I have to pay, my premium is $480 a month. Again, it's gone up, and it went up so much this past year because I had to, in order to keep my doctors, I was diagnosed with cancer last year. In order to keep the doctors and keep seeing my oncologist and my surgeon, I had to sign on to the more expensive policy this year. If they were to increase that 500%, they may as well just kill me now, because that it's not going to happen. And even if I were to say, okay, I'll stop doing my radio show, I'll go out and find a job, who's going to hire a 57-year-old woman at any kind of a salary where I could afford $2,500 a month for an insurance policy?
Right. I mean, it's a catch-22 in that regard. And these were the sorts of problems that the Affordable Care Act was designed to fix. You know, I joined HCAN in June of 2008, right before we officially launched. And I was there until the bill passed in 2010. We spent day in and day out working with economic experts and policy experts and doctors and nurses and patient groups and Planned Parenthood and community action groups and the NAACP and the Children's Defense Fund. I mean, we were all on board, labor unions, you know, designed, we created the set of principles that was designed to help us all stay together as the legislation moved through. To say, here are the things that we're looking for in a healthcare bill. This was all healthcare related. What we're seeing now in Congress, none of those people are involved. Oh, they've all come out against this piece of legislation. Yep. All the patient groups, all the advocacy groups, anyone who cares about the well-being of people has come out and said this is an abomination. Nobody's out there defending it on the merits. You don't see anybody in Congress saying, we really believe in this healthcare bill. You're seeing Trump say things like, great plan, lower cost, tremendous, very, very good, exciting, tremendous. I mean, there's no specific. And then you don't have members of Congress coming out and defending it either.
No.
So that tells you everything you need to know about what this is, and they're not proud of it.
Okay, so nobody is. And it was thrown together. Look, and you know full well, just by virtue of your experience, there was hearing after hearing, and it was written in three different committees, and then there were conference committees, and then there were more hearings, and then, you know, Obama brought all the senators over to Blair House to hash out questions and answers, and yet what you hear from Republicans is, well, this is how the Democrats did it. They wrote it in secret, and they pushed it through in the dead of night, which is just complete and utter nonsense.
I was on the outside, and I knew what was in that bill every step of the way.
That's right.
So, you know, if you think that they was done in secret, then I apparently had some Dakota ring I didn't know about, because I was fully aware, and I was not part of the administration.
Right. So let's say that the more sensible minds prevail. The so-called moderates in the caucus say, no, I can't sign on to this. It is cruel. It's mean. This is a no-go. It's dead in the water. Do you see any chance that the Democrats and Republicans could work together and actually fix the Affordable Care Act? Because what we know is the Republicans have sabotaged it through the risk corridor and not making the payments to the insurance companies to make up the difference when the numbers didn't come out as projected. And I'm way oversimplifying it, probably not explaining it well. But they're the reason, the Republican sabotage of the Affordable Care Act is the reason why it's not doing everything it should be doing now, why some companies are pulling out of the exchanges.
Yeah, I mean, I think if I had to guess, I would say that what's going to happen is we're going to have to start to see fixes on the state level. It's like what Washington State did. They found a couple of counties where there weren't insurers in the marketplace, and they talked them into participating. I think it's the kind of thing that's being done out here in California, is that what's not happening on the national level, we're making inroads on the state level. I saw a summary. It's like the states that want the Affordable Care Act to work are making it work.
Hmm.
It's succeeding in the states that have legislators and lawmakers who are willing to work to make it work. right? You need to have right. the buy-in. So I think that we'll continue to see those advancements on the state level. I don't think, unfortunately, until we get Democratic control of the House and Senate and hopefully the White House, that we'll start to see improvement on the Affordable Care Act. But if it survives this barrage, the next step will be improving on it, because it is far from perfect. Nobody who worked on it thinks it's perfect.
No.
We all believe it needs improvement. But improvement doesn't mean tearing it down and hoping that nobody notices. Improvement means building on the work that we did and making it better over time.
Jackie, in the minute or so we have left, sorry to throw this on you in the last minute, but you mentioned California. I know you're living out there. Yeah. Miami says hello, by the way.
Oh, I miss Miami. It's my hometown.
It's hot as hell down here. It's so miserable. Anyway, I know it's miserable out there too. The single payer was on the docket for California, and the Democrats, a Democrat in the House seemed to put the kibosh on it. Do you know what happened there?
Yeah, from what I understand is there was no financial game plan for it. There was no way to pay for it. And, you know, what I've been reading, I didn't follow it all the way through, but what I've been reading now in the aftermath is that it doesn't do us any good to put the principles out there without any strong financial plan. You got to figure out how to pay for it, and there's got to be a roadmap for that. And until we've got that down, it's not realistic. And I believe in single payer. The more I read about it, the more I know about it, the more I support it, I understand it. But the political reality in this country is that we need to figure out how to pay for it in order to make it happen. And those details just weren't there.
Right.
So I don't want to, you know, I don't want to bring the wrath of single payer advocates on me, because it's happened in the past, and I understand. I'm passionate about it as well. But you have to face the political realities of where we are, and we're just not there yet. We're closer. More and more people are coming around to the idea. But politically, I think that there wasn't a pay for. There wasn't any kind of plan to set aside money for this,
right,
and how we were going to raise the money to pay for it. And so the idea was, let's not have people fall on the sword when it's an impractical choice to have to make at this point. So,
Jackie Schechner, I can't thank you enough for being with us today. We can catch you Tuesdays.
It's my pleasure.
Tuesdays with John Fugelsang on SiriusXM Insight. And it's a pleasure talking with you again. Thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Take care. Bye-bye. All right. So now you've got your work cut out for you. Need to get on the phone again. TrumpCareToolkit.org has the phone numbers, has ways to tweet at these senators who might be predisposed to vote against this shit sandwich. Do it. Don't let up. Too much is on the line. Thank you for listening. We'll do it again tomorrow. In fact, my attorney will make a return appearance. He's got a few things to say about Donald Trump. Thanks for listening. Till tomorrow.
It's Thursday, June 29, 2017.
I think it's going to be a landmark breakthrough in coal technology, really around the world. First of its kind.
Or not. Experimental clean coal plant switches to natural gas.
The administration is tearing down the legacies of the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act.
Trump's EPA moves to undo landmark clean water rule. World's first floating wind farm takes shape off the coast of Scotland. Plus,
they haven't seen this in 28 years because we haven't done stupid stuff like this.
Utah lawmaker blames environmentalists for massive forest fire.
All of that inappropriate blame and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
We turn the Forest Service over to the bird and bunny lovers and the tree huggers and the rock lickers. We turned our history over.
Rock lickers? You're not crazy at all, Utah State Rep Mike Noel. This is your Green News Report.
I'm gonna soak up the sun.
Okay, Desi Doyen, I know you've got some big news on clean coal. This is our key to the future.
Yeah, except not so much. It's been a major setback for proponents of so-called clean coal. The nation's first commercial clean coal plant, the Kemper plant in eastern Mississippi.
I hear about it. It's great.
It was supposed to convert coal to a gas to generate electricity and then capture its carbon pollution. But on Wednesday, Mississippi Power Company announced it will shift the plant to burn natural gas instead. Mississippi utility regulators are cutting them off because the costly experiment was too risky to customers after years of delays, budget overruns, rate hikes, and more than $1 billion in funding from U.S. taxpayers.
So this is it? This is our clean coal technology, the future of coal that we've been promised for so long?
That's right.
And now it's shut down and they're just using natural gas instead.
Yeah.
So fitting.
The Trump administration this week officially kicked off the process of repealing President Obama's Clean Water Rule, a landmark regulation that clarified EPA authority to allow it to regulate how much pollution could be dumped in wetlands and tributaries that feed into the drinking water supply of one-third of Americans. The Waters of the United States rule has been on hold due to litigation from a coalition of fossil fuel industry groups, manufacturers, agriculture industry groups, and developers who argue the rule violates their property rights. EPA will now withdraw and rewrite the rule.
Well, who needs clean water anyway?
And it's not the first rule that the Trump EPA has withdrawn or postponed. Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Scott Pruitt has stalled safety regulations for hazardous chemicals established in response to that deadly fertilizer explosion in West Texas. Mm. He's pulled back regulations curbing methane emissions from oil and gas drilling that cause air pollution and contribute to global warming. He's also withdrawn more pesticides rules that were intended to limit exposure impacts to children and farm workers.
Somebody ought to hold an election.
And the Associated Press reports this week that EPA's Pruitt met with the CEO of Dow Chemical, the maker of the widely used pesticide chlorpyrifos, just days before Pruitt decided to withdraw a ban on that pesticide.
Total coincidence.
EPA's own scientists said the pesticide damages the brains of children, even in tiny amounts. The pesticide isn't up for a reassessment again until 2022. In Utah, a state lawmaker blamed conservationists for a wildfire that has burned more than 77 square miles near the Bryan Head Ski Resort in the Dixie National Forest in southern Utah. Utah Republican State Representative Mike Noel used the fire as an opportunity to call for more commercial logging in national forests.
We turn the Forest Service over to the bird and bunny lovers and the tree huggers and the rock lickers. We turned our history over, and the fire is going to destroy our soil, our wildlife, and we're going to lose our scenery, the very thing you people wanted to try to protect. It's just plain stupidity.
Yeah, you people and your stupidity. So does he have a point? Do we have all of this dead wood up there that should have been logged by the logging companies?
Well, forest ecologists say that while a century of forest fire suppression policy has indeed contributed to the increase in large forest fires, they also say that increased logging of those trees killed by the bark beetle epidemic would not have made a difference in this fire. Finally, some good news. A new frontier opened up in wind energy this week. Norway's state-owned oil and gas company launched the world's first floating wind farm off the coast of Scotland. Set to be fully operational next year, the Hywind project uses pioneering technology to anchor the turbines to the seabed and keep them upright, and could vastly expand the number of suitable areas that can be tapped for offshore wind farms. And also notable because it's an oil company behind the project.
Clean coal plants going to natural gas, oil companies moving to wind, dogs and cats living together. What kind of madness is this? Well, we'll find out in our next thrilling episode. Until then, we'll be off for a week over the holiday. I hope that you and yours have a safe and happy one. Don't forget, you can get more on all of our stories at greennews.bradblog.com. And you can find, follow, and share us worldwide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.